and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
Oh, and I'm Brandon Rhodes, and we are broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
It's a different kind of a radio talk show. We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
We're covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles, and alternative transportation, communications, the internet, weird things that aren't working.
So you only have half of your...
Dittos, yeah.
Half of your headphones are working, is that it?
Now it works.
Okay, well, something is obviously loose in the wiring somewhere.
As the girl said.
Yeah, the thing about the passport is that passports are ridiculously hard to obtain and ridiculously hard to modify. So Adele, my wife, and I are going to Germany, ostensibly, in, about a week now, or a little bit less. Her passport arrived in the mail yesterday, I think, today.
Okay.
It was misspelled. So Dittus is spelled with a U, but the folks at the passport agency apparently decided that Dittus was the preferred spelling of our last name.
So like the plural of ditto.
Yeah. So my wife had to call in and cancel work. Or like she's going in for like a couple hours tomorrow until she's no longer needed. And then she's going to drive all the way up to Seattle to the... it's not the embassy in the States. I guess it's just the passport.
The customs office.
Yeah, whatever it is where they make new passports. And she's going to scold them and have them correct it for her for free. So that involved like renting a car and lots of text messages and emails and looking up web pages.
Yeah,
I'm beat.
Why don't you just change your name to Dittos?
That might at this point almost be easier.
it would
take far less travel.
Yeah.
So, anyways, be warned if you're gonna go traveling abroad, you're gonna leave the United States of America. Be prepared and start early. If you're not in America, don't ever come here.
We will spell your name wrong.
Not because we don't want you here, just because like life is freakishly difficult. You know, I miss the days when borders were just imaginary lines you could walk across without any consequences.
Those were great days.
Yeah. So, anyways, we should probably get right to the audio here. We've got. First off, David Watson from Mass Bike, who is the Massachusetts equivalent of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, where they do cycling advocacy type things and taking care of people around the state as far as bicycling and active transportation are concerned. So my good friend Josh Zissen, who gave us the T-shirts that say Bike Safe Boston for his organization of the same name. He was the guy that took me around and introduced me to a couple of different folks. So the first interview was on a trip with him. His voice might even be peppered in there somewhere. He was kind of sitting in the background looking at his iPhone. So, the first conversation is with David Watson. The second conversation is with Pete Stidman. I met him at a cafe called Flower, which served me an excellent cup of coffee. Apparently, they're one of the better bakeries in Boston. Also, one of the noisiest
bakeries in Boston. Part of the BBB.
It's one of the noisiest bakeries in Boston. It's the first time I ever tried to do an interview in a cafe and probably one of the last, just for like audio quality. I think I screened out a lot of the background noise. I spent a lot of time trying to make it listenable. So anyways, we've got our interview with Pete Stidman after that of the Boston Cyclist Union. If I'm not mistaken, I think both of these are people that I was turned on to by Rob Sadowski of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. So
what a good man.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Mm-hmm. By the way, speaking of, I guess not specifically of the Transportation Alliance here in Portland, but Cycle Oregon opened for registration.
Yes, they did.
Was it Friday night or mm-hmm. Thursday night or something like that? Last weekend.
Sisters all the way to the coast, right? They're going south.
Yeah, they're doing like South Klamath Falls and kind of around those neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Lots of hills, apparently. But the thing sold out in like 2 hours.
That fast?
Yeah, it was like, 2,600 people where it was the limit of how many people
could
sign
up.
And like it was immediately flooded with people who just said, I want to go and take this week-long bicycle tour through Oregon. So good times. And congratulations, Cycle Oregon, for lasting that long. If you want to check them out, they're cycleoregon.org, I bet.
Is it going to go through Burns?
No, sadly.
Let's just say AOL keyword Cycle Oregon.
That seems like the best way to find people these days.
It is. It's very hot now. It's trending. It's trending, bro.
That's right. And well, without any further ado, then let me give you our interview with David Watson of Mass Bike.
I'm David Watson. I'm the executive director of Mass Bike, the Massachusetts Bicycle Coalition.
Yeah.
We're the only statewide bicycling advocacy group here, and we work a wide variety of things. We're working on legislation to make biking safer, and we've had some successes in that over the years. We do a lot of work with state and local agencies on access to roads and public transportation and also safety issues. We have an extensive education program for adults on bike in the workplace, also for kids through the Safe Routes to School program, which in Massachusetts is a centrally operated statewide program.
Okay, yeah.
And we also do all kinds of events. We have, you know, a ride series, and they're kind of different rides. They're not just sort of recreational rides. And some of them are really short, like we did the 4 mile Pi Day ride where,
Pi Day,
you know, we had 30 people meet us on Boston Common on Pi Day, which is March 14th.
Okay.
You know, 3.14.
Pi, the number.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the confections, but yeah, okay, yeah.
Well, that too.
Okay.
Because on Pi Day, we had 30 people meet us on Boston Common, and we rode 4 miles to a pie shop in Somerville and ate pie.
They celebrate the nature of the possible pun.
Exactly. And, you know, we do other rides that have, you know, like a historical theme or an educational purpose. And it's just kind of opening people's eyes up to the possibilities of what you can do with a bike.
Yeah.
And we've been providing, providing education for Hubway users, our new bike share system this year in partnership with the City of Boston. So we're hoping to expand that as Hubway expands to
kind of getting the word out.
Communities. Yeah, and just making sure that people know a few basic things before they head off into traffic.
I suppose that's kind of a volatile or almost a dangerous situation. Like you take someone who doesn't bicycle much and you put them on a bike, it could be disastrous unless people know how to make it work.
That was the fear that was being widely said before Hubway launched, that literally the streets are going to run red with the blood of inexperienced cyclists. And
it's
it can happen.
Bike apocalypse.
You know, I think Hubway's off the street for the winter now, and I think in total there were maybe 2 crashes, and neither of them involved serious injuries.
Okay, that's 2 crashes with Hubway users?
With Hubway users.
Okay.
Which actually is a much better safety rate than regular bicyclists.
Yeah, for sure. And regular bicyclists are always out on the road and always always there, so I guess there's more potential.
Yeah. But so anyway, we also run some large-scale events like our Summer Century, which gets a few hundred people.
Yeah.
And it's actually the Summer Century and Family Ride.
Okay.
Because we're always trying to capture a broad range of cyclists, not just, you know, the super commuters and the road warriors.
Right.
But, you know, the people who just want to ride a few miles. So
it's kind of like if you have a marathon, there's always like the kiddie toddle or whatever that goes for like a block. And
yeah, so actually I led the kids ride
at
last year's Century. So that was fun.
How far do you take kids on a ride? What's prudent and safe for that age?
Well, actually I led the longer of the 2 family-oriented rides, so that was about 20 miles.
Okay.
The shorter one, I think, was about 10 miles.
Nice.
And, you know, that's still a substantial ride.
Yeah. A lot of people out with trainers, that sort of thing? Or
I don't think anybody with training wheels, but we had 1 or 2 trailer bikes that
okay.
I saw.
Yeah.
And there were multiple stops, including for ice cream.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. You were getting to something. Or maybe I didn't.
No. But another big thing that we do is we run Bay State Bike Week.
Okay.
Which is our version of Bike to Work Week that happens every May.
Nice.
And 2 years ago, we took on what had been a regional effort called Bay State Bike Week.
Uh-huh.
And partnered with Mass DOT, our statewide Department of Transportation, which itself has only existed since 2009.
Is that right?
And I'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, please do.
But then for the first time in 2010, we had a truly statewide bike week. You know, it went from 65 events as a regionalized activity in 2009 to over 100 events in 2010, and we had, I think, about 186 events registered this year in 2011. And as far as we can tell, we're the only state that has a real statewide bike week.
Yeah.
That's and particularly one that's a partnership between the DOT and the statewide advocates.
That's kind of encouraging.
So
what time of year is that?
Exciting. That's in May.
Okay.
You know, the League of American Bicyclists designates one week in May, usually the second week as Bike to Work Week every year. And
nice.
You know, most states and communities, you know, pick up on that and do their own activities.
Yeah.
And we've kind of taken it to the next level.
That's great. I'd imagine Massachusetts is probably easier to do like a statewide bike event than like Nevada or Oregon or something like that. In Oregon, more than half of the state is entirely rural and dry. So
yeah.
Massachusetts seems a little bit more even keel as far as weather patterns and what kind of terrain you can expect to.
Well, actually, I don't know about that. You know, here in Boston, you know, most of the state's population, well, not most of the state's population, but about a third to a half of the state's population is in the Boston metro area,
okay.
And the rest of it is scattered throughout the bulk of the geographic area of the state.
Right.
Now, Boston itself is relatively flat and compact, which makes makes it really a great city for biking.
Yeah.
And not too far outside the city, though, you start to get some hills.
A little bit,
and
yeah.
The further west you get, the bigger the hills are. Until,
right.
You know, when you get out to the Berkshires in far western Mass, I mean, those are real mountains.
Right, you're talking about something that would actually cause you to huff and puff and all that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the kind of rides where you could have several thousand feet of climbing on your ride.
Yeah.
So we do have a really wide range of terrain here. You know, the interesting thing was that we had kind of pockets of activity around Bike Week before Bay State Bike Week started. And, you know, there was a lot of activity in the Boston metro area. There was a lot of activity out in Northampton and Amherst,
uh-huh.
Which is a really strong college community out there.
I think my brother-in-law's out at Amherst right now.
Yeah.
And, well, not right now. He's home, but... But yeah, that's where he goes.
Yeah,
to school.
So a lot of interest in biking and the environment out there, but that was kind of it. And you know, this year we got huge interest from, you know, communities in the Berkshires, communities in Southeast Mass, and more going on in Central Mass as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, parts of the state that hadn't really participated as strongly in Bike Week activities before were suddenly on board, and it felt like it really was a statewide event.
Nice.
Yeah.
So. It's almost like a hands across America, like you can bike tire to bike tire all the way across the state or something.
Yeah. But coming back to the fact that we've only had an actual DOT for 2 years,
yeah.
Until 2009, when the state passed transportation reform legislation, what we had was a loose conglomeration of completely independent transportation agencies that did little or no unified planning. That made our job as advocates a lot harder.
A lot of people to talk to, I suppose.
Well, a lot of people to talk to, and we're still talking to many of the same people, although they're now part of one unified agency.
Yeah.
But the really important change has been, from a planning perspective and a policy perspective, they really are one agency now.
Okay.
And so when we talk to the people who are thinking about sustainability and sustainable transportation, they're thinking about it across the board,
mm-hmm.
for, you know, highways and bridges and public transportation and, you know, even things like bike share and education.
Yeah.
So it lets us really work on making policy changes that will then trickle down to all of the different modes.
Yeah, and you've got consistency if you're going from one place to another, so... We were talking a little bit about that earlier, about just kind of knowing what to expect. And with you, Josh, and I, mm-hmm. it was legal stuff like knowing what laws are like, but knowing that you can have like the same standard of facilities from town to town, I would imagine that would be a great boon to bicyclists going long distances or from town to town.
Was it
on a city level before they unified it statewide or county or
no? I mean,
is there a county, sir?
We do have counties, but our counties don't really exist as political entities anymore.
Okay.
Right.
You know, there aren't county governments.
Sure.
And the counties don't do anything as far as maintaining roads or anything like that.
So it's just a geographic designation.
Yeah. I mean, here we have very, very strong home rule in individual communities. Every town controls, its own zoning and its own roads and bike paths and everything else. We do have some statewide requirements now that are very good for creating complete streets and bicycle and pedestrian friendly streets, but local communities are only required to follow those guidelines on state-funded projects.
Okay.
You know, when they're dealing with things using their local aid money, they don't have to follow the guidelines.
Right. It's whatever they like, whatever they want.
Yeah. So that's a problem. That's something that I keep talking to people about, making a real effort to change, because that can lead to inconsistent treatment within a community.
Sure.
Depending on where the funding for the project is coming
from. Yeah, yeah.
And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, because that will just confuse people and just lead to a much less friendly environment.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I guess it's the whole consistency thing. Like, it would be great if there were standards.
Yeah.
Well, how did you get into bicycling, back in the day? What got you into... Aside from maybe like having a bike as a kid or something, what sparked the fire for you when you grew up and became of age?
I got serious about it when I was about 14.
Okay.
And had just moved to San Antonio, and somehow got my first adult road bike and started riding with a club out there, and suddenly realized that I could go places by myself without a car, and eventually was doing maybe 60 mile rides out into the hill country around San Antonio. Now back then, when I first started, bike helmets weren't widely available, and I didn't have one. I didn't even have tools. I barely knew how to change a tire, and I certainly didn't have a cell phone, because they didn't exist then either.
So
I'm riding basically out into almost desert.
The hinterlands.
Thinking back on it now, if anything had happened, they would never have found my body.
Sure, sure.
So
far off the beaten path.
Yeah, so, but I'm still here. And
yeah.
Still loving bicycling. And, so I've pretty much done it consistently since then. I got really into mountain biking for about 10 years.
Okay.
And wasn't road riding at all during that period. And, was a volunteer mountain bike advocate. I was director of the New England Mountain Bike Patrol for a while, and a member of the patrol for almost 10 years.
Okay.
And that's a group that still today provides medical and mechanical assistance out on the trails and at events. And, eventually I heard about this job opportunity when the previous executive director was planning on leaving, and thought, that sounds like a good fit for me, and applied for the job, and 6 weeks later, I was a professional advocate.
There you go.
And you were a lawyer at the time, right?
Yeah, well, I guess I still am a lawyer.
Once a lawyer, always a lawyer. But,
I was actually practicing law at the time.
Okay.
I was in-house counsel for a high-tech company.
So you weren't doing bicycle-specific law work at the...
No.
It was just kind of...
No.
Not many people do,
to be honest. Yeah, it's probably not. It's kind of a niche field.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, being a lawyer has its advantages. It gives me instant credibility with legislators.
Sure.
And, has been good since I was able to rewrite a bill that MassBike had in the legislature for a bunch of years and hadn't been successful in passing, and that helped to get it passed. And we've got a new bill in the legislature, based in part on something that they already did in Oregon, the Vulnerable Road Users Bill.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that one, and I'm actually going to be rewriting it soon. I think I need to refocus it a little bit to make it more effective and make another push to get it passed in this legislative session, which we have another year in.
Okay, yeah. And the Vulnerable Road Users Bill in Oregon, was that passing distance in part? Was some of the, giving people space on the road, or what did that focus on?
That was focusing on increasing road safety by increasing the penalties for motorists who killed or seriously injured bicyclists.
Okay.
And there was also an educational component. Like I think there was a diversion program. Mm-hmm. So if you were charged with that offense, you rather than going to jail or paying a fine, you could choose to attend education and do community service.
Sure.
Instead. And so we picked up on a lot of that in the bill that I drafted.
Okay.
Adapted for the various strange aspects of Massachusetts law. Mm-hmm. And it had its first hearing in our transportation committee, and is still stuck in that committee.
Okay.
At the moment. So in the meantime, though, since that hearing, I actually had my own personal bad experience with a motorist on the road not too far from here, where I was stopped at a red light waiting for the light to turn, and a motorist decided they didn't like me being there and pushed me out of the road with their bumper.
Wow. Just kind of physically inched up and
aside. It might have been an accident the first time they made contact, but the second and third times it was definitely on purpose.
Pretty sure they know you're there.
Now everyone's going to know what drivers are like. But that's not what all drivers are like, by the way.
No, that's fairly unusual.
It's the exception, certainly.
But my experience, I did not have a bad experience with the police who responded to it, or anybody who I've dealt with as the investigation and the court process has gone on. They've all been professional and supportive and doing their jobs. But I can't say that I felt like the process was really geared toward protecting me as a cyclist in that kind of a situation. And
right.
I think, you could call that an assault.
Mm-hmm.
And I would call it an assault, although that's a tough thing to prove. But what I realized was that there's a real gap in the law here, where we really have no recourse for harassment.
Okay.
Whether it's involving physical contact or just people yelling at you or throwing something at you or anything like that. Motorists road raging cyclists is unfortunately a pretty common occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's somebody passing you a little too close or getting frustrated that they can't pass you and, kind of following too closely or honking at you or yelling at you when they pass by. So I'm rethinking whether we can actually extend the scope of the Vulnerable Road Users Bill to include some sort of protection against harassment. So that's where I'm going to be going over the next few weeks when I think about rewriting it and making a new effort to get it out of the Transportation Committee.
Yeah. Does that have anything to do with assumption of who's at fault or prejudice against bicycling, anything like that, or?
Not so much. I think there's just a presumption of innocence throughout our criminal system.
Yeah.
that you always have to overcome when you're making any kind of a complaint, and there are laws in some European countries where if a motorist hits a bicyclist, the motorist is presumed to be at fault.
Sure.
But that probably couldn't couldn't happen here because of the presumption of innocence.
Right. And for the way things work in America, it would seem kind of heavy-handed or like you weren't being given a chance or something like that.
Maybe. Although, you know, there are some strong arguments that the system is just inherently biased against cyclists. Mm-hmm. I mean, one good example is, if two cars are in a fender bender, most likely the drivers aren't seriously injured, and they're able to effectively communicate their story to the police. With an incident between a bicycle and a car, even a minor incident, at best, the bicyclist is in shock.
Sure.
You know, and at worst, they're seriously injured.
Mm-hmm.
And in either case, their ability to tell their story to the police who respond is compromised. I certainly, based on how I felt in my incident, and I wasn't physically hurt, although my bike was trashed.
Right.
But, you know, knowing how I felt and thinking back on how I was interacting with the officer, I was definitely in shock.
Yeah, that alone is traumatizing enough.
And, in the worst case, you know, the bicyclist is in the ambulance on the way to the hospital mm-hmm. while the police are there talking to the motorist and getting only the motorist side of the story.
Right.
So, you know, I think, you know, there could be an argument for having motorists bear some additional responsibility or even shifting the burden of proof to some extent. But, I mean, it's just a tough thing to do under the American system.
Yeah, for sure. I was thinking it'd be nice if you had, like, a little black box like they have on airplanes for your bike. And I remember reading about somewhere, like, there was a guy who used his iPhone GPS data or some other phone that was kind of... He was in some confrontation with a car, I don't know if it was an accident or something where he was trying to prove something in court, and he was able to use his positioning data. Like, he'd been tracking his where he was, and that was useful data, you know, because that helped reconstruct the scene.
Yeah.
So you had a little bit more of a chance in that case to have both sides explain.
But, sure.
But not everybody has an iPhone, so.
No. But, I don't want to focus on all the negative aspects because I actually think, it's a great time to be a bicyclist in Massachusetts and particularly in Boston. I mean, things have happened since 2007 when the city's bike program started. I don't think any of us would have imagined that we would have made as much progress this fast after so many years of the city largely ignoring the needs of bicyclists. And I mean, the community has exploded. You see all kinds of people riding bikes today, which is amazing. You know, when I started here at Mass Bike 5.5 years ago, it seemed like most of the bike commuters were wearing spandex and riding longer distances, and today it's completely the opposite. The vast majority of people are, you know, riding shorter trips, you know, wearing regular clothes, and it's just become one of their transportation options, and in many cases their preferred transportation option.
Yeah.
That's great to see.
I was impressed this morning. Yeah, just I can't think of one Fred, so to speak, that I saw on the road. Like everyone had ordinary street clothes on. It was interesting. I would say I see more spandex in Portland than I saw here today on my ride. So interesting. It's nice to see a cultural swell. And not that there's anything wrong with spandex. I don't prefer it, but it's nice that, you know, multiple styles of fashion can all exist.
Hey, I think everybody should wear what's comfortable for them to wear on their particular ride.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if spandex is going to work for me on a ride, I'll wear spandex. You know, if I'm just riding to work a few miles, you know, I'm going to wear something else that I'm more comfortable in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to have options.
Yeah. But, I mean, even just looking around this area where our office is in the financial district, almost every street around where we are right now has some sort of a bicycle facility on it, whether it's a bike lane or Sharrows or Well, you missed the hubway stations because they got taken off the street.
Right, I'll have to come back for that.
But we had one right across the street until a few weeks ago.
It's nice to have that as an option.
Yeah, and I use it, even though I ride my own bike to and from work. Once I'm here, if I need to go to meetings at the State House or the Transportation Building or wherever, and I've changed into my jacket and tie, I'm more comfortable just going downstairs and grabbing a hubway bike that's designed for riding, mm-hmm. Without getting your clothes dirty,
sure.
and just pedal over to my meeting and then grab another bike when it's time to come back.
Yeah, that'll work out nicely. They have fenders, I assume, and chain guards, all that.
The drivetrain is completely enclosed.
Okay, so chain case or something.
Yeah, there's nothing you can catch your clothes on.
That's nice.
And, and the things are bomb-proof.
Yeah.
I haven't had a problem with one yet.
Well, what would you say one or two of the things that you're most excited about coming up in the future for bicycling in the Boston area?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things we've seen this year is the continued surge in interest at the neighborhood level in making biking a better choice for people to get around their own neighborhoods and also to get around the city. The hubway system is really only in the downtown core right now. It doesn't extend out to the neighborhoods very much yet, and I think it really needs to reach its full potential, as well as expanding to the surrounding communities, because people aren't just riding around Boston. It's a common trip to ride from Boston to Cambridge or Boston to Somerville or, from Brookline into Boston. And if you can't make those trips on a hubway bike, you're missing a lot of opportunities.
Sure.
So, that expansion's really exciting, and there's a lot of potential. And it is going to expand next year. I'm not sure how much within the city, but definitely some of the surrounding communities are jumping on board.
Yeah.
But we're working more and more with underserved communities, mm-hmm. and introducing them to the idea of bicycling as transportation and helping them figure out what their priorities are that are going to work for their neighborhood, and then supporting their efforts to make those things happen. We had some great success in East Boston this year, where we partnered with a local community group and the Boston Collaborative for Food and Fitness, and trained local youth as biking and walking advocates. Mm. And they turned around and asked the MBTA to change its policy on bikes on the Blue Line during rush hour.
Has that been reversed?
Well, it's been modified.
Modified, okay.
To provide more access, sure. during peak periods. And that's not a complete solution,
mm-hmm.
but it's major progress.
Yeah.
And it's progress that the professional advocates like me had been unable to make on our own for many years.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we were able to engage people in the community to lead the effort that the team really understood the importance of making the change for the community, and that it wasn't just some kind of an academic advocacy exercise.
For the tape, we should explain just the subway here, or above ground train as well, here in Boston. Is it hours that are blacked out for bicycles? Like, there are certain times when you can put them on?
Yeah, basically on the subway system, the morning and afternoon peaks.
Right.
You're not allowed to bring bikes other than folding bikes on the train. And that's 7 to 10 a.m. and 4 to 7 p.m.
Okay.
And the change for the Blue Line, which connects from downtown Boston out through East Boston and then past that to some of the neighboring communities, is that in the peak direction, which is towards Boston in the morning and away from Boston in the evening, those restrictions are shortened by an hour.
Okay.
So we get an extra hour So it's four to six in the evening instead of 4 to 7.
Okay.
And 7 to 9 in the morning instead of 7 to 10.
There you go.
So it gives you a little bit more opportunity.
Yeah.
But maybe more importantly is if you happen to be commuting in the reverse direction, which is, you know, away from Boston in the morning and the opposite in the afternoon, there are no more restrictions.
There you go. So you can hop on any time and not worry about it.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't solve the problem for everybody.
Yeah.
But it solves the problem for some people, and it opens the door to continuing the conversation on peak hour restrictions with the MBTA.
For sure, yeah. And it seems like the biggest problem with transit oftentimes is that it doesn't play nicely with bikes. I know most transit agencies have limitations, like they only have so much space for bikes, they only have so much space for people, but it does seem like you know, if a transit agency can bend and can flex a little bit to meet the needs of its customers, then it's nice if it can.
Well, I mean, over the past couple of decades, the T has gone from totally uncooperative mm-hmm. to extremely cooperative
yeah.
With the bicycling community. I mean, we've got pretty good access to the system now.
Definitely.
And opportunities to improve that. Bike parking, the T has been really, I think, a national leader on mm-hmm. bike parking. And the station nearest to me, which is at the end of the red line, has parking for 500 bikes,
yeah.
including two secure parking facilities called Pedal and Parks.
Okay.
And they're card key access with a special Charlie card.
Oh, there we go. Nice.
Which is our you know, electronic pass.
Right.
And,
is that an Alewife?
That's at Alewife.
Oh. I think I just rode yeah. past that the other night.
And I bet I wasn't there today, but I would bet that even today when it's a little chilly mm-hmm. and rainy, I bet that bike parking's pretty much full.
Yeah, and that's a great option because the transportation only goes so far, and if you live a little farther away than the end of the red line or anywhere else, and you need to bridge that gap with a bike. Either it's faster than the bus or more convenient or there is no bus service and you need to either walk or bike.
And, you know, those high-level secure facilities are coming to about half a dozen other stations very soon.
That's impressive. That's a big effort.
And also at about 50 other stations, there's covered bike parking. So
okay.
not secure, but a little bit protected from the elements.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I would say that's our biggest downside to Portland's bicycle network is that there's a lot of bike parking but very little covered bike parking, and in a place where you get a lot of rain, it's a nice amenity to have. So
yeah.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. My wife and I rode out to Concord yesterday.
We call it Concord.
Concord, excuse me.
I don't know when to say anything.
I've got my West Coast mispronunciations. My apologies.
Don't try and say Worcester.
Right, right. Yeah.
Well, and forget about Bill Ricka.
Oh God. Yeah.
Is that it?
Well, you might look at it and call it Bill Erica.
Oh, okay. Right, right. It's just dropping a syllable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what Dorchester, right? It's
that's right.
Just still has the yeah.
Dorchester.
Because it has the H, right? Or no. Or,
no.
No rules,
yeah,
just
no
rules. Tradition.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, David. Thanks for sharing some of your thoughts. And
welcome.
Yeah. If people want to get into Mass Bike and look at what else you guys do, it's massbike.org.
Massbike.org.
That was a guess, but
and we're also on Facebook and Twitter if you prefer that.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much.
That was our interview with David Watson from Mass Bike. Next up, the interview at Flower Cafe in South Boston with Pete Stidman from the Boston Cyclists Union.
Tell me a little bit about the Cyclists Union. How did you get started with them?
The Cyclists Union, well, I helped found it by pulling a group together back in January 2010. Of people who were doing advocacy in different parts of Boston. So the way the Boston scene has been in the past is that, you know, There's a lot of students and younger folks in Cambridge and Somerville, so there's a pretty strong bike culture out there. But our group is really focused on inside the city limits of Boston.
Okay.
And what we can do to improve things here. I mean, Cambridge has now something like a 5% bike to work rate, and Boston is right around 1.4-2%.
Okay.
So we got some catching up to do, and also, you know, we wanted to sort of get into neighborhoods that weren't really traditional for bike use. Like we know in Boston, if you're familiar with it, Jamaica Plain has, you know, a ton of bike use, and it has a Southwest Quarter, really nice greenway.
I think I rode on that last summer.
Yeah.
Or, well, it would have been the summer before last, actually. But yeah, it's beautiful.
It's really nice. And, you know, but a lot of other neighborhoods in the city don't have those kind of facilities. So the bike rates are obviously much lower. And, you know, there's also cultural differences. There's new immigrants. There's people of color, neighborhoods of color, that just treat biking in a different way. Actually, Roxbury, in our experience, a predominantly black neighborhood, has a high number of cyclists in it, although not easily counted in the same way they would do other neighborhoods.
Sure.
Because, you know, it's more dispersed on the sidewalks and side streets.
Right. Not integrated with traffic.
Not as much.
Yeah. So it's harder, like, you can't just put a guy, like, at a bike lane on an intersection and say, count the bikes, because they might not be in the lane, or there might not be a bike lane.
They didn't have bike lanes out there until the last couple of years. I mean, the whole city didn't really for that until about 4 years ago. But we sort of helped build support in those neighborhoods for bike lanes on streets like Talbot Ave, Blue Hill Ave, Columbia Road, areas that weren't initially focused on by the city. But now the city is really focused on equity.
Mm-hmm.
So they're working with us on a lot of different projects.
Nice.
And really, you know, I don't think the Boston, the improvements in Boston could have happened without Mayor Menino, because he's been around for a long time.
That's what I hear.
16 years.
And those aren't consecutive terms, right? Just like
they're consecutive.
They are
terms.
Consecutive. Yes. So he's been the man in charge for a long time.
Yeah, but you know, he didn't come around to it in the beginning, way back when. But he has come around to it in the last 4 years and has done a lot. I mean, Hubway was a city initiative, essentially. They've come out with a lot of things on their own.
Hubway, the bike sharing setup, yeah.
Yeah, in addition to the things we asked for, you know, they come out with good ideas of their own. So it's a good situation here.
That's cool. So you started the Cyclist Union, basically. You're the founder.
Well, I called a bunch of people together.
Founding
member. So there's
member.
About 20 people at the first meeting. From all parts of the city.
Okay. Yeah. And David was telling me that just in the past couple of years, Massachusetts, the state, has finally gotten a Department of Transportation, unifying standards and that sort of thing. Does that play into the Boston proper thing, or is that more the mayor you think that has to do with the improvements?
You mean the reform, transportation reform? So Mass DOT becoming one organization as opposed to a bunch of separate, like
exactly.
the transit and all that. I think that plays into, I think that helps us on the advocacy side, because you have fewer agencies to deal with.
Sure.
You know,
like you can call one guy instead of like one organization.
Essentially, there's one guy that has a stronger oversight of all of them now. That was the case back then with the secretary, but now it's just much more direct, I think.
Okay.
And, you know, when you have the agency, the secretary supporting bikes and walking, then it goes down to the highway department, to the transit, the DCR, all the different.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't really done my homework, so I didn't get a chance to look into the your website or anything. But what is it you guys focus on, like, primarily? Is it commuting or transportation?
I mean,
we're
promoting the bicycle as transportation, and we're basically our there's a lot of bike groups in Boston, but our niche, I would say, would be grassroots organizing.
Okay.
We're not the only ones doing it. There's a lot of neighborhood groups out there. But we're the biggest group of size that's really focusing on outreach and, you know, bringing people to planning meetings and teaching people about bike facilities in neighborhoods that weren't thinking about it before. So one of our flagship programs is called Bike to Market,
okay.
where we go out to farmers markets all over the city. We hit 16 different farmers markets three times each last year, or this year, earlier this year, total of 50 events. And at them, we fix bikes for free. And we also, as they're waiting, talk to them about bike lanes, cycle tracks,
yeah.
show them a map of the neighborhood, and ask them what they'd like to see different in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
So we are forwarding now like a lot of requests for bike racks and stuff like that to the city. Also starting to work with housing or tenants associations to work on getting indoor bike parking at like housing developments and a number of different projects.
Yeah, is indoor bike parking a hard thing? Is it a hard sell, or is it something that people are kind of excited about?
Tenants organizations are as political as any other.
Yeah.
So, or if not more. So, because it's where you live. So
right.
it's going to be a long process, I think, for some of those. But once we get across a certain threshold, maybe it will trigger some sort of domino effect.
Mm-hmm. That'd be nice. That's the bike to market. I think Josh might have told me about that as we were walking one day. Just about, is that what you have, like mechanics that volunteer their time, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we hire some of the mechanics actually that graduate through Bikes Not Bombs, mechanics. So the first year we did it, 50% of our mechanics were under 18.
Wow.
And we basically, we invite a lot of volunteers there, and we have a couple of paid mechanics for each one, and that sort of bottom lines the effort. We set up a tent, we're at the farmer's market, so people are coming by anyways.
Yeah.
Normally, we really don't have to advertise for it because people see it and they turn around, go get their bike from the house and drag it over.
Like they're close enough, they live in the neighborhood where the market's happening,
yeah.
so they can come by and say.
Yeah, in Boston we have a pretty strong farmer's market scene. So it's not just kind of in the she-she neighborhoods, it's also in, it's pretty much in every neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because, they're trying to push nutrition. And so our angle actually combines the good nutrition with getting good physical activity. And something in the area, we're still entering the questionnaire that we did this summer, but something in the area of 10% of the bikes that we get to fix weren't being used the previous month, so they're basement bikes or garage bikes.
Just like it's been around forever, but it broke once and they've never fixed it.
Exactly. So, we're actually getting those people back on those bikes.
Yeah.
And so having a direct effect, so we might have done maybe 100 of those. 1,000 bikes all overall last year.
Yeah, and that's a huge thing because not everybody. I remember when I first started cycling for transportation, I got really excited about the whole fixing your bike and knowing how it works and that sort of thing. But I understand that not everybody's that mechanically adept, or not everyone has the time or interest. To get that done. So
there's another side to that, which are the kids that are riding in the neighborhood with the bikes. The repair we see the most often, especially with youth, is brakes.
Sure.
They get a new bike from Walmart or whatever.
Yeah.
And the brake shoes wear down after a while, and nobody in the family really knows that you need to keep replacing those.
Right.
And often the brakes are really poor quality, pressed steel that bend really easily. So, I think, and I hope that we're reducing the crash rate out there as well.
That'd be nice. We do, in my neighborhood in Portland, we do a bike fair or bike fix sort of thing for kids at the elementary school. And I'm amazed. I don't even know that much about bike repair. Like, I got a bunch of friends that are better at it than I am. But I think all of us just looking at the bikes that come through, just realizing that, these things are abused. And brakes are, and not only like the shoes wearing down, but also like the hardware, the cables stop sliding through the casing.
Yeah.
The whole setup just gets ridiculous.
Yeah, we see a lot of brakes, bikes out there that the kids have just taken all the brakes off of them because they get in the way after they're broken. They're flipping around.
Totally, yeah.
So they just strip them
shoes.
And then they have no parts. And, so next year we're looking actually to get whole brakes out there as some of our parts. We normally just have all the replacement parts like the cables and the noodles and all that.
Yeah.
But, we need entire brakes.
It's pretty cool, and you guys hire the mechanics, so it's not just like mechanics that have like the goodness. I'm sure they're good people. Like, I'm sure they enjoy what they do, and they know it's doing a good thing. But it's probably also easier to keep mechanics doing that if you give them some sort of incentive or
it's about half and half. And this year we're looking at doing them in one spot. Like last year we did one a month.
Uh huh.
for the entire summer at 16 spots. And this year we're looking at doing it once a week because we think that we're going to build more qualitative relationships, and also so that it could work for advocacy, but also it could help teach people bike repair and actually maybe step them up into a vocational program that like we have here through Bikes Not Bombs.
Yeah, you're teaching them to fish instead of just giving them fish.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Essentially.
Nice. Are you a mechanic? Do you do any repair yourself?
I'm like a home mechanic.
Yeah,
I'm not the fastest, the greatest, but when things get really crazy, I chip in too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to have friends that know stuff. What else does the Cyclist Union do? It sounds like the bike to market is a big deal.
Well, one of the, most exciting things to me that we're working on now is on the advocacy side. We're, Boston right now is seeing a number of potential removals of highway infrastructure.
Really?
Stuff that was built in the 50s and 60s. So there's three projects. One is in Somerville, so it's outside of our jurisdiction. Uh-huh. It's called the McGrath Highway. That one looks like it might not be getting taken down soon, but remains to be fully seen.
Okay, which one is that again? That's the
McGrath Highway.
Okay. Is that 93?
No.
No.
These are all sort of just, they're not like interstates.
Not interstates, but just right. That like local big street things.
Local roads that have been overbuilt.
Okay.
Another one is Rutherford Avenue and Sullivan Square in Charlestown, where we've done a lot of work. We won a bike lane last year that was actually opposed by one of the community groups there. But we managed to win them over. So we had a good organization there. And then
was that a difficult one? Like, were they pretty staunchly opposed to the bike lane?
Well, Charlestown is one of the more traditional neighborhoods in Boston. Still very Irish and conservative in some ways. But actually, once we got down to it and started talking to people in the neighborhood, there are a lot of cyclists.
Yeah.
And we find that everywhere we go, that every community has a lot of cyclists in there. You just have to go and find them.
Kind of root them out.
And then you have people that have lived there their whole lives that are on your side. So that's sort of why we focus on the grassroots.
Yeah.
The last project is actually the one we're having the most success with. It's Casey Overpass and Jamaica Plain.
Okay.
Jamaica Plain, as I mentioned earlier, is one of our strong areas for cycling in Boston. And there's a bridge over part of it that was designed, they hoped to carry, maybe 50, 60,000 cars over Jamaica Plain when it was built, but ended up not having that kind of capacity. And so it's more of a capacity of a boulevard, like around 36,000 cars a day. So we've organized with a lot of other groups, including some forest groups like the Emerald Necklace Conservancy, people from JP Center South Main Street, which is a business group, and Walk Boston and the Arborway Coalition, a local group there, to basically, instead of building another bridge that would carry cars through, build more of a neighborhood that would be friendly for walking and biking.
Sure. So, like, reduce speeds, more space in the streets for all kinds of users.
It would reduce speeds. It would also just make it much more attractive as a place to actually hang out in.
And
we think encourage people to ride bikes. It also, due to some of the idiosyncrasies of the plan, allows only in the at-grade option to build a connection up to some, a cycle track connection up to some bike lanes that go into a neighboring neighborhood, Rosendale. And that is basically an extension of the Southwest Corridor, one of our best bikeways in the city.
So, and is that's the one that parallels the Orange Line? Is that right?
Parallels the Orange Line. It was actually intended as a highway when they first cleared the area.
Is that right?
I-95 was going to go through there.
Wow.
The neighborhood fought against it and won, and then they built the Southwest Corridor. They put the Orange Line there, and then they built the Southwest Corridor Park.
Yeah. So that was purely like a grassroots sort of like, we don't want this
right
here sort of thing.
And in a way, our efforts now on the Casey, and to me, not to everyone in the neighborhood, but to me, mirror that old activism of trying to make a neighborhood, that is more friendly for people walking and biking around than just to get cars through.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of in Portland, Oregon, there was a there was a highway plan back in, I don't know, like maybe the 60s or 70s when the interstate system was still being constructed. And they had planned a highway from downtown out towards Mount Hood, kind of just, you know, leading out through the suburbs. And that was a thing where they were going to take out multiple homes and destroy neighborhoods and tear them apart. And it was a similar sort of thing. People just said, yeah, that doesn't sound very nice. We like things the way they are.
Right.
And so it was they overturned it. There are still highway exits on the I-5, I think, that would have connected to that highway, but it was just never built. So.
Right. In this case, they tore out the whole neighborhood before they decided.
Oh, okay.
To build it.
So the neighborhood was gone, but at least it did not turn into a large throughway.
And now it's a bike highway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's probably the most used bikeway in Boston.
Okay. Yeah, was that also post highway plan? Okay, so the orange line wouldn't have gone through there if the highway had been built.
Yeah.
Okay.
The orange line was moved actually from another street, Washington Street, nearby.
Okay.
And put there because it was an elevated before.
Okay.
So, you know, preference to put it on the ground.
Yeah, definitely. Because now I guess it's kind of halfway between train and subway in that neighborhood because it's like below ground or like below the surface, but it's not covered in a lot of places.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Actually, you know, the fact that it's not covered is, like, kids love it. They, like,
right.
are always up against the fence.
You can stand there watching the trains go by. Yeah. I was that kind of kid. I always loved it. It's the sort of thing like my parents hated it when, you know, we got stopped at railroad crossing and the train was going by, but I was enthralled because, you know, you get to see a train, so.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. That's cool. Are you from the Boston area?
I'm not, and, you know, I guess if that was widely out there, it might be an impediment, but I'm from Colorado, originally, Denver, Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And growing up, you know, I saw Denver just expand horizontally over the Front Range.
Yeah.
And it made me so sick, really, that I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that I get so interested in urban design and bikes and public health, because I just saw what happened in Denver. It's just, it's atrocious.
Yeah.
If you look at the maps between, you know, even 10 years ago and now, it's like almost doubled in size.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Do you want that part off the record? About being from Denver?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I've been here about 11 years now.
Okay.
And I've worked at, you know, neighborhood newspapers.
Yeah.
And I've really come to love Boston, and I consider it my home.
Yeah.
So
there we go. Yeah. Well, it's probably more the commitment than where you're from that people care about, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've been in Portland about 10 years or so, and I'm starting to feel like a local. Like, it feels more like home than any place else does.
Yeah.
So.
I would not be considered a local ever.
No,
in my
sure.
life, even if I was here for 90 years.
Yeah.
If you're not born in Boston, you're not a local. So.
Right. That reminds me of what I've heard about Maine. I can't remember the name of the book. There was kind of like a These United States project, but more contemporary, where they had authors and writers. They wrote little chapters on each state in the union, and the one on Maine was talking a little bit about kind of like how you can move in, but like, you know, 80 years from now they'll still say, oh, that's the guy from somewhere else.
Yeah,
it's kind of funny how a culture identifies
itself.
It is.
I mean, Boston has so many different subcultures. I mean, that's really one of them. You know, that local folks, but there's a lot of new people moving in. I mean, it's really a diverse city.
Yeah. Are you personally acquainted with Rob Sadowski? Have you met him?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. He was, I think, the one that pointed me in your direction, so.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's cool. We had him on the show back, trying to remember. It's been, like, sometime last summer, I think.
You're lucky to have him out there.
Yeah, he's cool. I'm trying to remember. Did he spend some time out here, or? Because I know he was from Chicago.
Well, I'm not sure, actually, but I know him from the Alliance for Biking and Walking, just, you know, some of that conferences.
Yeah, getting together and putting your heads together.
Yeah, all the cities.
In a meta sense, yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like, I don't know, I feel like I should almost get into like advocacy, just to have those conversations. I think it'd be so fascinating to meet people from all over and hear.
It's kind of interesting to see the progression and to really see, you know, people that come from different backgrounds learning the political side of how to really change things. You kind of have to toughen up a little.
Yeah.
It's not just pointing out the good facts.
Right, right. But what would you say, like, maybe in a nutshell, what are some of the biggest challenges and some of the things you're most excited about coming up for Boston, the city itself?
I think the biggest challenge is always the hearts and minds challenge of really, you know, talking to everybody in the city about the benefits of biking and convincing a large enough part of the population that it actually could be really good for them.
Yeah.
You know, we have a paper here called the Boston Herald, which regularly writes articles as if we're in war with cars, bikes versus cars.
That sounds a lot like Portland's Oregonian.
Really?
Yeah, it's like the sensationalism of newspaper. Just kind of like that's the, you kind of invent controversy if you can't dig any up.
Yeah, I mean, they thrive on controversy, and they're not shy from it.
Yeah,
so
we actually had there was a summer series almost in the Oregonian of like three or four different consecutive headlines, maybe like, you know, for one week to the next, it would be like, you know, the war on cars.
Yeah, well, we see some of the most egregious from other cities, too, you know, we keep track of that. But it's, yeah, that's the biggest thing. And I think, you know, it's really just a matter of reaching enough people and talking to enough people and being able to make the argument. Because once you do, I mean, everybody has a connection to bikes at some point in their life, almost everybody. And it's usually a good memory.
Right, yeah. Yeah, unless it, like, ended with a skin knee or something like that, I guess. Or,
yeah.
Or gravel up the palms or something like that. As far as, I don't know, it seems like Boston's a college town. You got a lot of kids that come in, and the bicycle is kind of sort of as transportation, but... But, I mean, I remember when I was in college, I didn't take very good care of my bike either.
Yeah.
And then there's, I noticed that the legal situation is interesting, just like the way that people decide to behave on the streets and, like, either knowing or caring about, like, how bikes interact with other kinds of traffic. Does that seem like a big issue to you guys, or do you think it's...
I mean, we're lucky to have stronger laws than a lot of states in the nation, but, you know, protecting cyclists and giving us some rights, like riding two abreast and all that kind of stuff. But, there's definitely a slow uptake on education, both on the driver's side and the bicyclist side. And there's always a lot to learn. I think that's going to be a consistent problem.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the more we grow, the more people we have to educate, and education is particularly expensive.
Sure.
It's not something that even the state could afford.
Yeah.
At a high scale. But, you know, things like their, you know, MassBike, actually our statewide group, is working with the state on improving the driver's license education. So that, you know, drivers are taught how to act around bikes. Mm-hmm. Both the Boston Cyclist Union and that MassBike worked last year with the bus drivers to create some education there and like a remedial process by which you can report a bus driver and they would...
Like transit, like the T?
Yeah.
Okay.
An MBTA bus driver. And they, you know, if they're regularly reported by cyclists, they'd go through a remedial education course.
Okay.
A couple hours. You know.
It's nice to have an option for that, I guess, just to be able to.
It's nice to have something there, and you know, like another thing that I think the Boston Cyclist Union has helped do is to build a lot better relationships with the Boston Police.
Okay.
Which, you know, historically, the sort of hardcore members of the cycling culture have had a problem with, you know, and
kind of still, bad odds with.
Yeah, well, we still hear about, you know, isolated incidents where officers mistreat or just talk down to cyclists. But, you know, for the most part, the leadership now, and actually for the whole part, the leadership is fully behind, you know, making cycling a safer option. And treating cyclists right. Actually, last year, instead of crackdown on cyclists, which could have happened, the police handed out warning tickets for people who ran red lights, but also handed out helmets same time. So it's kind of a mix of nice guy, bad guy, I guess.
Sure,
good cop,
sure.
Bad cop.
They're playing both sides.
But ultimately, something that probably did a lot of good.
Yeah, I imagine, I mean, systemically, you talk about like changing hearts and minds. If you have the system aligned with your own goals for kind of improving the cycling dynamic in the city, that goes a long ways towards making it a better place.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a really tricky line for politicians to walk. You know, there's a lot of their constituents are, you know, push back against something like a bike lane taking up a parking lane, or just taking up even narrowing traffic lanes. We've seen news stories about how that is so bad for motorists, even though really, you know, the effect is pretty minimal.
Yeah, it's amazing how intensely political that can get.
Yeah,
and so quickly, it's a flashpoint. Well, what are you most excited about in the future? Would say the next couple of years.
I'm excited about Boston. It continues to get better all the time. The city's laying in about 20 to 30 miles of bike lanes every year, and you know they're putting in the long-term commitment as far as we can see, and it's pretty dense city. It's pretty flat. It has a lot of advantages for cycling. We have the highest walking rate in the country at 13%.
Yeah,
walking to work. So I think that's a strong indicator of what Boston can become. So I'm just generally excited.
That's great, man. Well, thanks for taking the time on the tape. I appreciate it.
No problem.
And that's the end of the interview with Pete Stidman from the Boston Cyclist Union. Just as a side note, he and I had a little extra conversation about the nature of streets in Boston and how they go everywhere, and they're not on a grid. But he said there was a bonus point to that, and so that's what this little snippet is here.
All right, so, yeah, I think that's another one of the advantages of Boston is not being on a grid, because if you're in Chicago or something and you're going up a particular street, I guess Milwaukee cuts diagonal, and that's a popular bike street, but most times you'll have to go straight in one direction, take a right, and then go straight in another direction to get there. So you're obviously going out of your way. But in Boston, from any location to any location, there's almost always a direct route. So
oh, sure, yeah.
You'll never know it in your first 3 to 5 years of living here. But
yeah,
after
I sure
that, it's gold, because really, I think you get from point A to B much faster than anywhere else.
Right, right. But, you know, I never considered that. We've got like 3 diagonal streets in my town. And so it's, you know, I mean, they can be useful. But yeah, more often it's more of a kind of a zig and a zag sort of mentality. But yeah, if you can go directly from one point to another, yeah. I had never even considered that.
Yeah, well, you know, it gets really complicated. Like, you might take 37 different turns to get across town, but you got there really fast.
Yeah, for sure. When I came down, I am staying in Medford up, pretty close to the Medford Square. And we came down Main Street, hooked up with Broadway, and then I guess Maine in Georgetown, but it was almost a direct shot. You know, there were almost no turns. There was a couple of merges or one road turns into another. But yeah, it was very convenient.
And that was our interview with Pete Stidman of the Boston Cyclist Union. Thanks everybody for sticking around and listening to some stuff from abroad. Depending on where you're from, it might actually be your hometown or closer to where you live. Well, hey, Brandon, it's been a good show.
Man.
Trick is, we didn't actually listen to it. We're doing this like 5 minutes after we recorded the intro. But, you know. So anyways, we will look forward to seeing you guys next week. Next week, we have an interview recorded in Boston with Dan Sorger of, and especially, he's a great guy. And that's my phone ringing. Well, hey, I'm going to answer that, and we're going to close out the show. So, it's been, wow, we got noise coming from everywhere. Well, hey,
this is a real fuck up.
This is the Sprocket Podcast. We are at thesprocketpodcast.com. Write to us at thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Text us or call us 503-847-9774. Find us on the Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thank you to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. He's on the internet at myspace.com/RyanJLane. Thanks to Hurtbird for our headline sounder, which we did not use, but they're at hurtbirdmusic.com. Well, Brandon, this has been a fantastic episode,
man,
and we will look forward to next week. All right, see you later. Bye.
Bye.
Best day ever.